morning is a recording for Kathy Drury with the American Hospital Association. This is the November National Contact Call on Tuesday, November 14th, 2014 at 11 a.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone, and thank you for holding. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the call over to Ashley Hoffman. Ma'am, you may begin.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the November National Content Call for On the Cusp, Stop Clotty. We're so excited to have you with us for today's event, which is going to focus on what to do when your clotty rates aren't improving. Before we begin today's presentation, just a quick reminder that this is a webinar, so please be sure to log in through the webinar link in order to see today's slides. We'll also post a copy of the slides and the recording on our project website. So now I'd like to introduce our presenters today. Dr. Sanjay Saint is the George Dock Professor of Internal Medicine at the University of Michigan, the Director of the VA University of Michigan Patient Safety Enhancement Program, and the Associate Chief of Medicine at the Ann Arbor VA Healthcare System. His research focuses on enhancing patient safety by preventing healthcare-associated infection and translating research findings into practice. Also with us today is Dr. Sarah Krein, a research investigator at the Ann Arbor VA HSR&D Center of Excellence, also a Research Associate Professor of Internal Medicine and co-director of the VA's Diabetes Quality Enhancement Research Coordinating Center. Her research interests include understanding and improving management of patients with chronic healthcare conditions, specifically those with complex or multiple chronic conditions. Also with us today is Dr. Kathleen Fletcher, an associate professor of internal medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the Milwaukee VA Medical Center. She is interested in research about how patient care and patient safety are impacted by medical education. And without further ado, my pleasure to introduce today's speakers. Dr. Saint?
Great. Thanks, Ashley, and hello to everyone. It's really a pleasure to be with all of you this afternoon to talk about preventing clotty and what happens when your rates aren't falling as low as you would like them to go. I'm going to get started. If I can advance the slides, terrific, thank you. I'm going to talk in general terms about catheter-associated urinary tract infection and how to prevent clotty, and that this will be similar to what you may have heard us discuss in the past, and then I'll leave it to Sarah to talk about next steps when your clotty rates aren't falling, specifically what's plan B, C, and D. Kathleen will talk about some research that she's been doing, and then I'll come back at the end to talk about applying mindfulness in clotty prevention. So as we all know, UTI is a common cause of hospital-acquired infections. Up until the time when the definitions changed, it used to be the most common healthcare-associated infection. Now it's one of the most common healthcare-associated infections. Most of these infections are due to the use of urinary catheters, specifically indwelling Foley catheters. Up to 20% of inpatients are catheterized sometime during their hospital stay. It can be for just a few hours during surgery or for several days or even weeks. And it also leads to increased morbidity and healthcare costs. But there are also important non-infectious harms related to the indwelling urethral catheter. And in fact, many of these non-infectious catheter-associated complications are at least as common as clinically significant UTIs. These can be as minor as maybe some blood in the tubing or in the bag or some discomfort or pain at the time of insertion or removal, but it can also be quite severe, such as creating a false passage during the time of insertion, urethral strictures, urethral trauma, and then inadvertent removal of the Foley with the balloon inflated. So I think it's important to consider both the infectious as well as the non-infectious complications of the Foley. And in fact, this is something that our colleague, Dr. Mohammed Faqih, has spoken eloquently about, in that there's a lot of urinary catheter harm, and even though we're focused on clotty, but we also know that patients with a Foley who have it removed may not urinate for several hours, in which case that may actually increase length of stay. It also leads to discomfort and trauma, as discussed. But the urinary catheter also can act as a one-point restraint, tethering a patient to the bed, which leads to increased immobility and therefore pressure ulcers, VTE, as well as falls. The complications in yellow are actually targeted by the Partnership for Patients. And since many of you are working as part of the hospital engagement network, as you can see, decreasing the use of urinary catheters can not just decrease CAUTI rates, but also can decrease the complications, decrease the rates of other hospital-acquired complications. So how do we go about reducing catheter use and preventing CAUTI? Well, we've conceptualized this in this project as disrupting the life cycle of the urinary catheter. Just like the organisms that lead to infection have a life cycle, so does the Foley, from insertion to maintenance to removal and reinsertion. And let me just quickly go through these one at a time. And the first is preventing unnecessary and improper placement. So the unnecessary placement has to do, especially in the emergency department, and to a certain degree, the operating room. Many patients who are currently getting catheterized probably don't need to be catheterized. And if they do need to be catheterized, we should make sure that proper aseptic technique is used, as recommended by the CDC. Unfortunately, when we've looked at this issue, both in the emergency department as well as the operating room, we find that between 20 and 50% of the time, when being observed, healthcare workers, and it could be medical students, physicians, nurses, nursing aides, are not using proper aseptic techniques. So I think there's lots of opportunities for improvement, at least in step one, not putting in the catheter unless it's absolutely necessary, and then if it's necessary, using proper techniques. The second area where we can intervene is the maintenance phase and properly caring for the catheters. And this has to do with making sure that the bag is below the bladder, that there's no loops or coils that will impede flow of the urine into the bag, that there is situational awareness and vigilance about every day who has the catheter and whether it's necessary. And that will lead then to prompting catheter removal, which has really been the key focus of the national work. This is actually where most of the research resides in terms of preventing CAUTI and preventing catheter-related harm. In fact, there are over 30 studies that have looked at nurse-initiated discontinuation protocols, catheter reminders, whether they be written or computerized, and what they've found is that there's over a 50% reduction in CAUTI with this approach, no evidence of harm being reinsertion of the catheter, and this also, of course, will address the non-infectious harms of the Foley. Ideally, this would be automated, or this would be part of a discontinuation protocol. And this is, again, something that hopefully most of your hospitals have in place. And then finally, once removed, we should make sure that the patient does not get the catheter reinserted prematurely. It's going to be expected that the patient, if they're able to urinate without the Foley when they got admitted, they should be able to urinate without the Foley at some point, either during hospitalization or shortly thereafter. But what happens, especially in elderly patients, and specifically elderly men with large prostates, once they have a Foley in place, their bladder then can become deconditioned, and they suffer from something known as bladder apne. Once that Foley is now removed, it may take several hours or even days for their bladder to regain function. And we should use intermittent straight catheterization until the patient is able to urinate on their own. And there are protocols that are available on our website, catheterout.org, and other resources available through the project website that you can use to know when to use a bladder ultrasound scanner, what's the cutoff in terms of the volume in the bladder that will require intermittent straight catheterization. Let me just spend a moment or two on the ICU, because what we're finding in the national data is that the intervention on the floors, both in the medical and surgical side, have led to about a 30% reduction in CAUTI rates. So I think it's been quite successful. And this is in the setting of a much more modest decrease nationally as reflected in NHSN data. However, in the ICU, we haven't had as much improvement. In fact, it's been relatively flat. And this is in the setting of NHSN data actually showing ICU rates going up in terms of counting. So I want to just spend a moment discussing the ICU, because this is where a lot of catheters are used. And in fact, the utilization rate in ICU is somewhere between 60 and 80%, depending on the intensive care unit. And much of the justification that is used is that the patient is critically ill and therefore needs strict I's and O's. But what we've realized during site visits and appropriateness panels is that just because a patient is in the ICU does not mean that the patient needs a Foley. What we recommend is that if hourly assessment is needed because we're titrating pressors, we're titrating medications, diuretics, etc., then the Foley is the only way to manage that person's urine output. However, if hourly assessment is not necessary, and what we're really looking for is daily assessment, then other approaches, such as intermittent straight catheterization, a condom catheter that is well-fitting, and there are certain condom catheters that fit better than others, and happy to discuss that if you have questions, on appropriate men who do not have bladder output obstruction. Bedside urinals, commodes. We're being much more aggressive in mobilizing ICU patients, even those who are ventilated, than we were before. And I think once you start thinking about removing the A line, removing the central line, you're getting patients up and out of bed and putting them on a treadmill, or other types of things in terms of preventing long-term harm, that's a good time to also think about maybe I should remove the Foley in this ICU patient, even though they still reside in the ICU. So again, the key question for us is, are hourly assessments of urine output required? If so, makes sense to use a Foley. If not, rethink the use of the Foley catheter. So that's our kind of basic approach to preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infection, especially focusing on removing the catheter with alacrity. But what if you need further help in preventing pouty, which is often the case? And so for this, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Sarah Krein. Sarah.
Great. Thanks, Sanjay. So as just discussed, I'm sure a lot of you are already focusing on those key strategies that Sanjay described for us and have been very busy trying to reduce CAUTI rates at your facilities. But we also recognize that sometimes, despite your best efforts or what you think may be going at your facility, things just are not progressing as you might hope. So in the next section of the talk, we're going to focus a little bit on some potential strategies you might employ. So first, we're going to have a polling question. And so I'd like you to select your top contender for what strategies you have used or considered using if your CAUTI rates are not as low as you might like. And we have running up and down the hallway screening, conducting a focused review or deeper dive to identify improvement opportunities, ensuring competency in insertion using aseptic technique, assessing what indications are being used for catheter use, talking with staff about possible barriers to prompt removal. So I'll let folks select their choice, and then we'll see what people are doing or thinking of doing if they're having some difficulties.
So go ahead and select the radio dial. We'll give everyone about 30 more seconds to get your answers in. Right, and now everyone can see the results.
We have some interesting results. So most people are thinking about focused review or a deeper dive, which is a great strategy, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Assessing what indications are being used, I think that's also often an area, and as Sanjay just mentioned, one of those areas in particular to focus on maybe the ICU. We have some folks who are talking with staff about possible barriers, a smaller percentage who are thinking about competency with respect to insertion, and a couple of you are running up and down the hallway screaming, so that's probably normal as well. Great. So let's move on to the next slide. Thanks, Ashley. So we have a couple of approaches that we're going to suggest to you as possible alternatives and things that you might consider if you are, again, having some of those challenges in reducing your CAUTI weights. So the first, you can go on to the next slide, is what we call the Tier 1, Tier 2 approach. And this is something that we implemented a couple of years ago in working with a network of hospitals in the VA system. And we had 7 hospitals that were implementing a CAUTI prevention program. But we recognized up front that sometimes there could be some challenges. And so what we instituted was a tiered approach. And in Tier 1, we started out with a lot of the strategies that I suspect many of you are implementing at your facilities. So assessing for daily need for the indwelling catheter, encouraging the use of alternatives, use of a standard kit with pre-sealed junctions, so the closed kit, ensuring proper insertion technique. And then we also had instituted a maintenance and removal template. So this was part of the electronic medical record that would prompt the nurse to do a daily assessment or shift-based assessment of why that catheter was in place, and if not necessary, then prompt a removal activity. As we were doing this, we were, of course, measuring rates, and we set up criteria if after 6 months you did not meet the threshold, which in this case was 2 CAUTIs per 1,000 catheter days for both the ICU and the non-ICU, we would then shift attention and give some guidance on moving into the Tier 2 protocol. And this protocol included some of those strategies that we just saw some folks are already thinking about or using, which was, for example, to do a root cause analysis or some focused review of CAUTI events to see is there something going on that we haven't really been addressing quite as well as we should. It also was an opportunity, I think, often to reassess those indications for catheter use. And I know in some facilities, really making sure that people understood what those indications were and were using them appropriately. With, again, the issue of using catheters in the critically ill patient being one of those key areas where potentially there was opportunity for improvement. In the Tier 2 protocol, another sort of enhancement was to be a little bit more aggressive, perhaps, in assessing and documenting competency of healthcare workers who are doing the insertion. And I know we've seen a lot of opportunities here as well, sometimes because it's not something that some nurses do on a regular basis, or because we're very busy and sometimes we forget what the process is or do not take our time, we may not be performing quite appropriately. So this is another opportunity where we would often see room for improvement. So this was some areas where we thought a little bit more intensive focus and activity and a little bit more resource-intensive activity would often help people then move back into that Tier 1 protocol. So this is one strategy, again, is to kind of get a little bit more beneath the hood to see if what you think is happening at your facility or what you'd like to see happening is actually happening, and then also identify other opportunities for improvement. Next slide, please. Now, the second approach that I'm going to talk about is called the CAUTI GPS. And next slide, please. And this is actually a CAUTI prevention guide to patient safety. And the purpose behind this CAUTI guide to patient safety is to provide a brief troubleshooting guide to help identify key reasons why a hospital or a unit may not be as successful as they might like in preventing CAUTI. And then once some of the barriers are identified, help identify possible solutions. And I'm going to go into just a little bit of detail about how this was constructed and how you might go about using this tool, as it's a relatively new tool, and so we'll be very interested also in your feedback on how this might work. Next slide, please. So the way the CAUTI GPS was developed was through a course of studies and over several years of work in which my colleague Sanjay Saint and I were trying to understand why some hospitals are better than others in preventing infection. And so we spent a lot of time doing work, both quantitative and qualitative, focusing specifically on device-related infections, but really focusing a lot on CAUTI prevention in particular. And this work was funded by a variety of federal agencies. And as part of that work, as I mentioned, it was both quantitative and qualitative. And in our qualitative work, we did phone interviews and site visits to hospitals across the United States to learn from them what was going well, what wasn't going so well, and in some cases to work with them to see if we could help make some improvements. And in the course of this work, I believe we visited probably over 40 hospitals, or I shouldn't say visited, either by phone or in person, over 40 hospitals and talked with well over 400 hospital personnel, and this ranged anywhere from frontline clinicians up to hospital directors. Next slide, please. And just to give you a sense of the types of hospitals we visited, it wasn't just those large city hospitals, although we did spend some time in some large cities, as you see there on the left side of the slide. So big hospitals, academically affiliated, tertiary medical centers. But we also spent time in smaller rural hospitals in our own state of Michigan. And we visited hospitals literally from Maine to California. And along the way, we had a few adventures, I will have to admit. So it wasn't all work. We actually did indeed end up in the middle of a field because that's where the GPS told us the hotel was located. We did go on some rather interesting plane rides in small regional aircraft where you had to get on a scale before they put you on the airplane so they knew what to tell you to sit. And for any of you who have been to San Francisco and have gone on a taxi ride, I think you'll know what I'm talking about. It is not the most pleasurable of events. But amongst all of those events, we also did learn a lot about what is going on in these hospitals and ways that we thought we could help them improve, especially with respect to CAUTI prevention. Next slide, please. Now, I can also tell you that these site visits take a lot of time and a lot of resources, and even though we learned a lot, and I think the hospitals benefited often as well because we were able to work with them, we also realized that we needed to distill what we were learning and the things that we were hearing from the hospitals themselves about barriers as well as strategies to address those barriers into something that a variety of hospitals could use across the country, since I don't think there's any way that we'll end up going to all 6,000-plus hospitals in the United States. So from all of this work, we've developed a tool that a hospital or someone at the hospital, you as a CAUTI prevention champion, can self-administer to identify some potential challenges and then receive feedback and some strategies for improvement. Because over the course of our work, we really were able to, I think, key in on some very specific areas that were consistent across all those hospitals that we were visiting, large and small, academic, non-academic, that seem to be the areas of greatest challenge. So the first part of this tool is the CAUTI GPS brief assessment. So next slide, please. So the next slide is showing you that assessment, and as I said, it is very brief. It's a series of 10 questions. Well, okay, there's a few more if you kind of parse question 10. And it's simple yes-no questions. So things like, do you currently have a well-functioning team or work group focusing on CAUTI prevention? Do you have a project manager with dedicated time to coordinate your CAUTI prevention activities? I'm not going to go through all of these, but I think you're getting the idea that there is really some key areas that we felt were important for CAUTI prevention, and again, those areas where we were seeing the most difficulty at some sites with being able to accomplish and reduce their CAUTI rates. So this CAUTI GPS assessment tool, we were basically using it in a paper form as we would go out to hospitals and as we talked with people. We would have them complete it. We would look at their results and use it as a way to prompt some conversation and to help them strategize. But we've also now taken it and put it into a web-based form so you can go on our website. So next slide, please. And use the tool itself. You can print it out if you want to use it in paper form, but it's actually now live online, so you can go in and do your own self-assessment. And we also now have all the questions linked to some troubleshooting tips. So again, not just to be able for you to say, this is an area where I'm having some trouble, but we also wanted to provide some feedback about ways you might address those issues. So if you go to catheterout.org, this is actually pretty new. It's just gone online the last couple of weeks. So again, we're hoping to get a little bit of use out of it to see what people think. Next slide, please. So I apologize, I know this is a little bit tough to read, but I just want to give you a sense of the output that you're going to receive. So I actually went in and I did the assessment tool and chose my yes and no answers. And as you can see, so for example, in question two, I said I did have a project manager with dedicated time. So I get a little bit of feedback telling me that that's a good thing, and this is some reasons why. But in areas where I was having some more difficulty, so an example here is question five, where I said, no, my bedside nurses aren't taking initiative to ensure that the catheter is removed when it's no longer needed. I get some feedback, but I also receive an additional link that I can now use to get even more specific strategies to help me think through how can I start to address this issue. So next slide, please. So if I were to click on that link, again in question five, I would now come to this additional information about some ways that other hospitals have used in order to address getting that timely removal element, which is part of that life cycle disruption for the catheter, into place. And so, again, this is all kind of a work in progress, and we're very excited that it's finally up on the website and actually something that people can begin to use. So next slide, please. So I would highly encourage you, if you so choose, to go online and check it out and give us some of your feedback. Let us know what you think, providing the name of one of our project managers, Alyssa Gaze, who you can certainly email and let her know what you think about the tool. And if you have suggestions for us, we're always interested to hear and make even further improvements and refinements to this tool. But because we created the tool, we also felt it was important to validate the tool and get some more experience using it, because we are researchers after all, but also want to make this of utility for folks out there, such as yourself, who are working on CAUTI prevention. So I'm now going to turn things over to Kathleen, who's going to talk about the validation project that she's been engaged in and some of the things that she's been doing with the GPS.
Thanks, Sarah. So I'm going to spend the next couple of slides telling you a little bit about the validation project that we've been working on from our site, and also tell you a little bit about some lessons that we've learned so far from the data collection and the data analysis that we've done that I hope will be helpful as you think about trying to identify areas where you may be able to make interventions if your CAUTI rates aren't coming down. So the goal of this project overall was to assess, we had two major goals. One was to assess unit-level culture surrounding the prevention of CAUTI and other hospital-acquired conditions. We talked about this a little bit, actually not last month, but 2 months ago on this call. And I know that there has been other work, and even in that call we talked a lot about the work that Sarah and her colleagues had already done. But also, as Sarah mentioned, we have been interested in comparing the CAUTI GPS survey answers that the nurse managers are giving to qualitatively derived site assessments. So that is really more the focus of today's talk by me, and so I'm going to tell you a little bit more about what I mean by that. Next slide, please. We have gone to 4 academic institutions and done site visits and interviews with interested parties on 2 units per site, 1 MICU at each site and 1 other unit. The participants that we've been interviewing have included nurse managers, staff nurses, including clinical nurse specialists, physicians, and hospital leadership. And by that I mean usually infection control preventionists and quality officers. The data collection has looked like this. One of us interviews the nurse manager after asking him or her to complete the CAUTI GPS survey tool, and we interview them about the answers that they gave on that survey to make sure that we understand how they were interpreting the questions and why they answered the way that they did. The other one of us then conducts interviews using more open-ended questions with the other staff involved on the floor, as mentioned above, like the staff nurses and some physicians who work on the floor. And then we also did observations on the units as well, mostly walkthroughs with members of the staff, and looked for evidence of ongoing projects relating to patient safety and specifically to CAUTI. Next slide, please. As we have collected this data, this has allowed us to focus our analysis in the following way. So the interview data allows us to do a couple of different kinds of coding. So we go through the interview transcripts and do some inductive coding, and that means basically reading the transcripts and seeing what themes people are talking about. And we talked a little bit more about that 2 months ago when we talked about what people were saying about the culture about CAUTI prevention on their units. We've also done deductive coding, which basically means that we went into looking at the transcripts with some ideas about what we were going to find. And in this case, we coded specifically for how people talked about the elements that are also asked on the GPS. This allowed us then to look at what the nurse manager said was true of their unit, the nurse manager said was true of their units on the GPS that they took, and we were able to compare what they said to what other people on the unit said in their more open-ended interviews about each of those questions. So today what I'm going to talk about is how some of the other people compared to each other. So not just the nurse manager perceptions compared to everybody else, but also what did senior leadership say and how did that relate to what people on the unit actually said was going on in terms of CAUTI prevention? And, for example, how did the nurses view CAUTI prevention on a specific unit and how did the doctors view CAUTI prevention on that same unit? And I think that we'll find some interesting discrepancies and some that leads to some interesting ideas about how the GPS can be better deployed to help identify these discrepancies and maybe point us in a different direction in terms of interventions. Next slide, please. So one example of this is, I'm just calling this Get on the Same Page. So this is these are some examples of how senior leadership sees CAUTI prevention efforts differently than the unit level workers do. So our observation is that infection control and quality officers are not always on the same page with nurse managers as far as what is going on at the unit level. So, for example, there may be institutional level programs that are being rolled out that are not necessarily getting down to the level of individual units. I use Champions as one particular example where at some institutions they have identified nurse and physician champions at the institution level, but there are people on the units who have no idea who those people are or that they even exist. Another example is that our sense was that infection control and quality officers did not actually know what actual preventive practices were being put into place on individual units. They may know that it's a priority for the hospital to reduce CAUTI rates, but as to what individual units are doing, they often had no specific ideas about that. And then how data is given back to the front lines. So this is a much clearer arrow when we're talking about units where reporting is required, so for ICUs and for rehab units, for example. But on general medicine wards where these rates aren't necessarily followed yet, especially at the national level, then the reporting back to the front lines is often not as consistent as one might want. And so while the nurse managers, for example, know that the data is being collected by someone, the feedback can be pretty spotty and also not too timely. But I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a later slide. So one idea would be to ask the infection control professional or the quality officer in your institution to actually take the GPS with your unit in mind to find out how much they actually know about what your unit is doing, and then maybe to use that as a starting off point to have a bigger discussion about how institutional programs can be better rolled out on your unit and how your unit's experience can maybe inform what the institution is doing. Next slide. Okay, so I think it's almost intuitive that nurses and doctors may have different ideas about what's going on with respect to CAUTI prevention on a unit. And our observation was that as a physician, I'm embarrassed to say this, but that doctors often have no idea about the formal CAUTI prevention practices that are ongoing in their units. We really went to observe some units that had some pretty sophisticated stuff going on where the doctors really it was completely opaque to them. So the doctors really have no idea what the nurses do with respect to CAUTI prevention sometimes. And the MDs also are not aware of the existence of either MD or RN champions. So that led us to think that if we actually asked some key MDs on the floors to take the GPS, that could allow for some pretty aggressive education based on the gaps that you identify. So it may not be that you have every MD who works on your unit take this, but if you can identify some people who have a significant presence there, maybe on general medicine floors, that might be hospitalists. Obviously in the MICU, that would be more of this staff intensivists. And then you could actually design some education tailored based on what the gaps are between what you know the nurses are doing and what the physicians think the nurses are doing. Next slide, please. We also found some interesting things about physician involvement in county prevention activities. So our observation was that physicians are often only passively involved in the efforts. So, for example, most people agree that when we talked about this in the GPS survey and in our open-ended interviews, that physicians aren't totally on board with county efforts, and I'll refer back to my previous slide, which is that they may not even know about them. But it's fairly uncommon that people identify them as an actual barrier. So this makes me feel that there's room for more active partnering with MDs to move the dial more towards fully embrace rather than more towards being a barrier. And again, I think the GPS can help us understand where we are on the unit so that we can decide whether this is something that would actually be beneficial for your particular unit. Next slide. And then share the outcomes data. So our observation is that data is not consistently getting to the frontline MDs or RNs, especially, as I said, on the general medicine units. So, for example, many people know that data is collected. Many don't know exactly what data is collected, but they know it is. They don't even necessarily know by whom. Few know how it's used, and few actually see the results. And I didn't write this here, but even the ones that see the results, it's often not even in a remotely timely way that could allow them to really do their own deeper dive into a situation to figure out what went wrong. So our ideas here were to really think about questions 8 or 9, which is, do you collect the data and do you feed it back? And actually look at how both MDs and RNs on your unit answer that question. If it's true for your unit that the MDs and RNs often don't know whether data is collected or whether or not or say that it's not fed back, then I would suggest reassessing the feedback mechanism. Data can be a very powerful motivator, and I saw that also on Sarah's slide for why to do this. And so I think people really like to see how they're doing as a unit and also how they're doing compared to other units in the hospital. So I think that this is an important one, and the GPS can really help you understand whether this is something that is lacking on your own unit. Next slide. So if those ideas don't work, there are other excellent resources available. For example, this book, which is authored by some of our other esteemed colleagues presenting today, and this can offer some very good suggestions as well for preventing hospital infections, not only county, but I recommend this. And with that, I will turn it back over to Sarah and Sanjay.
Great. Thank you, Kathleen. And Sarah, for that overview of what to do in terms of Plan B, first discussing Tier 1 and Tier 2, and then the county GPS, and then Kathleen's work validating the GPS. I'd like to now turn our attention to something that is not as well developed, and it's more a work in progress, but I want to share it with you to elicit your feedback and thoughts, because this is another approach that may be useful in terms of preventing county, and this has to do with applying mindfulness to county prevention. And if I could just have the next slide or have control of this. Yeah, thanks. So since we're all in healthcare, we realize that there is this dilemma that confronts us, and that is much of what we do, especially in the chaotic environment of a hospital, is reflexive. If a patient's hypoxemic, we give oxygen, without even really thinking about it. They have low blood pressure, we push IV fluids. If they have positive blood cultures, we give antibiotics as soon as possible. And if a patient complains of urinary frequency, urgency, dysuria, we diagnose UTI and, again, provide antibiotics. And these rote responses are usually helpful. However, this reflex-like approach can lead to problems. So if a patient is sick enough to be admitted from the emergency department, they're deemed sick enough for a Foley, even though we know that a large percentage of patients who have Foleys who are admitted through the emergency department probably don't need a Foley. We could collect their urine using a bedside urinal, a condom catheter, using intermittent straight catheterization. those types of things. And the same thing is true if a patient has no symptoms, they have a Foley catheter in, and they have a dirty urine. Even though they feel fine, we give them antibiotics. And for most of the time, this would not be appropriate. They shouldn't receive antibiotics. So there's this tension between rote responses that are helpful most of the time, but the same cognitive processes that underlie those rote responses kind of lead us astray part of the time. So one possible solution to this kind of dilemma is medical mindfulness. And what mindfulness means is that we should be in the moment, and we should consider decisions carefully before jumping to reflexive action. And it's based in large part on the work of the Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman in his book Thinking Fast and Slow, where he talked about two systems of thought. One is system one, which focuses on intuition, which is fast, automatic, effortless, and quite difficult to alter. This is a system that we use when we drive home from work every day, kind of on autopilot. We're not even thinking about making a left turn here, a right turn there. And if we are told that we need to stop by at the grocery store to pick up some milk or bread, often we go right by the street where we're supposed to turn because, again, we're operating under system one, which is intuition, and this is the rote reflexes that I previously discussed. The second system really has to do more with reasoning. This is system two. It's much slower, much more effortful, and because of that, we tend not to use it that often. But when we do use it, it's more flexible. We're kind of thinking about what we're doing, and therefore it's easier then to alter our driving pattern if we need to do something other than go straight home. And in medicine, we're constantly toggling back and forth between the reflexive and the complex. So how do we apply this to everyday practice in general, and how do we specifically apply this to catheter-associated urinary tract infection? Well, one of our colleagues, Hiroko Kiyoshi-Tio, who's a nurse researcher now in Oregon, she came up with a model of applying mindfulness to bedside nursing and specifically focusing on catheter-associated urinary tract infection. I have the reference there in case you want to learn more about it. But what she would recommend is that we should take a 3 to 5 second pause before doing various things, such as inserting an indwelling catheter or emptying the drainage bag or transporting the patient, and asking during this brief pause, is it absolutely necessary to use an indwelling catheter in this patient? Can I use an alternative, like a condom catheter? Should I be using intermittent drape catheterization? Does the patient need any type of external device or any device at all? Or are they able to use a bedside commode or a bedpan or a urinal? And if the patient does need the Foley, the pause can be used to question whether or not we're using proper aseptic technique. Do I need to ask for help because the patient's body habitus is such that it may be difficult to insert this catheter without touching the inner thigh? And then also every day and ideally every shift that the bedside nurse is asking the question to themselves, can the catheter be removed today? And what do I need to do to make sure that that happens? So this is something that has not actually been systematically studied through an intervention, but it's something that I just will mention to you because it may be something useful, and I think it could also be bundled with other type of mindfulness approaches to prevent diagnostic error or reduce other hospital-acquired complications such as falls or pressure sores. So let me just conclude, and then we'll open it up to questions, answers, and a discussion that hopefully we convinced you that CAUTI and indwelling catheter use are important patient safety issues. Not only will there be infectious harms due to the Foley, but there are also important non-infectious harms due to the Foley, many of which are being targeted by the Partnership for Patients. So removing the catheter soon or not putting it in the first place will have benefits in terms of reducing your CAUTI rate, but also some spillover benefits in terms of potentially reducing other complications. There are proven approaches to reduce catheter use. It's been studied extensively. It's what we're using in this 950 hospital study. And at least when it comes to patients on the floor, it's been successful with about a 30% reduction. Additional approaches, however, are available to you if you're still unhappy with your CAUTI rates, especially in the intensive care unit. It could be a tiered approach, as Sarah mentioned, where you ensure that everyone is doing tier one, but that if your rates are still higher than what you would like, then you can focus much more on insertion indications, aseptic insertion technique, and doing focused reviews or mini root cause analyses every time you have a CAUTI or every time you find that a patient has an indwelling Foley for inappropriate reasons. The GPS can also be used. This is something that is still in the testing phase, so as Sarah mentioned, please give us feedback. We're happy to modify things. As you can see from Kathleen's discussion, we're formally studying this because we want this to be a model not just for preventing CAUTI in the acute care setting, but perhaps it can be modified to prevent CAUTI in the long-term care setting. We're in discussions with the CDC to use something like this or having them develop something like this for antimicrobial stewardship, which has all kinds of problems, or other types of hospital-acquired infections such as Clostridium difficile infection or CLABSI, especially CLABSI due to the use of PICCs. And then finally, I just introduced the concept of mindfulness. I realize that it's still preliminary, but I think it's intriguing, and it's something that patients are increasingly interested in. I think there could be some relevance to us in healthcare, especially when it comes to bedside nurses who want to further reduce CAUTI rates. But I'll leave you just with my thanks for the work that you've done, the work that you continue to do. I think all of us are inundated with challenges. Right now, Ebola is chief among them. But in addition to dealing with personal protective equipment and screening for patients who may have this potentially life-threatening illness, is that focusing on some of these endemic problems, such as CAUTI, remains important and will continue to be important. So thanks for listening to us, and I think at this time, Ashley, we'll turn it back to you and open it up to questions.
Yes, operator, can you please give the instructions for participants if they'd like to ask a question?
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. And once again, to ask a question, that's star 1. Our first question comes from Kathleen Steinman. Ma'am, please go ahead.
We have, through our reviewing of our CAUTI cases, found that our long-term neurologically impaired patients in the ICU can be part of the root of our high CAUTI numbers. They're getting but a lot of our straight caffeine protocols address somebody who has where you can restrict their fluid intake and such. So then the straight caffeine and the bladder scans, you can set relatively easy criteria for somebody who's stable. But what are some guidance for the patient who might not need a Foley but's going to be in the ICU for a long period of time that's not the stable type of straight caffeine protocol doesn't apply?
So, Kathleen, this is Sanjay. Let me first address this, and I'll see then if Kathleen or Sarah would also like to address it. Let me just ask you a question. When you say they're not stable, are you talking about hemodynamically stable and therefore that you need frequent assessments of your urine output because they're on pressors or diuretics or getting fluid resuscitated? What do you mean by unstable or potentially unstable?
They're neurologically unstable, but so not where they're needing the pressors. Part of our criteria for strict INO, we would leave the Foley catheter in. But when you get beyond that, where they're hemodynamically stable,
but they're neurologically unstable and they're still in the ICU, we're struggling with being able to get the catheter out of these patients.
Mm-hmm. And are these patients able to urinate on their own, or do they have urinary retention because of injured spinal cords or those types of things, thereby making condom catheters in appropriate men not an option?
That is the case. Yes.
Yeah, no, I think that it's, I'm glad you brought up this important issue. We've actually done site visits, and specifically in a couple of places where they, like you, have also had issues in their neuro ICU patients for a couple of reasons. One is that these patients often have high temperatures, not because they're infected, but because of central reasons, because of their neurological problem. And then, as you know, someone spikes a temperature, someone has a Foley catheter in, you culture the urine, and it grows out something, then you've got yourself a cowdy. Even though the vast majority of those patients, when you ask the clinicians, are you going to treat the patient for catheter-associated urinary tract infection? The answer is no. But still, in terms of rates, it would count against you. My recommendation is that if you need daily I's and O's, then somewhere between a Q4 to Q6 hour ISC protocol would make the most sense. I think the most frequent you can do ISCing in most places is about every Q4 hours. But the fact that these patients reside in the ICU, so therefore the nurse-to-patient ratio is actually pretty good, I think Q4 hours would make a lot of sense. And as long as they're not getting a lot of fluids or a lot of diuretics and you're using intermittent straight catheterization, I think that that protocol also makes sense. The cutoff for non-ICU patients and non-neurological patients tends to be between 250 to 350 cc's. I think in the ICU setting, you can kind of change that kind of depending on what else is happening to the patient. Clearly, it should be an ISC if the amount of urine in the bladder is more than 500 cc's. But if you wanted to increase it up to maybe 400 cc's from the usual 300 cc's, you could do that as well, especially because it does not sound like in those patients hourly assessment is required because you're making changes based on that hourly assessment. It's more, you know, every day or perhaps every 8-hour shift or 12-hour shift where you kind of want to have a general sense of their I's and O's. Would that potentially work in your place?
I think it may. What we had done was that we had just set across the board, across the institution, a straight catheting protocol, and it doesn't seem to be sitting very well for our ICU patients that are hemodynamically stable.
Yeah, and so you're bringing up, Kathleen, another important issue, and that is often a one-size-fits-all strategy does not work. And in fact, a one-size-fits-all strategy, even for ICU patients, may not work. That each unit, I mean, at our place, we have a surgical ICU, a medical ICU, et cetera, and the cultures are different. And the medical director is different. The nursing manager is often different. And so that I think it's fine to have one general recommendation, and the general recommendation would be bladder scanning with an intermittent straight catheterization protocol is better than having a Foley catheter in, but that it can be tailored for the individual unit and the patient population, and then even further tailored for the individual patient in that particular unit.
Thank you very much.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, that's star 1 on your touchtone phone now. At this time, I'm showing there are no further questions.
All right. Well, while we wait for the participants to think of questions for our guest presenters today, I do want to remind everyone, take a moment after today's webinar and complete our evaluation. I'll put the web link over in the chat area. You can click on it directly, and I will open up the SurveyMonkey link. We appreciate your feedback and your suggestions on future content calls as well.
At this time, I'm still showing there are no further questions.
I'm also going to take a moment to highlight our two upcoming content webinars for December and January. So December is going to feature Dr. Lisa Lubomsky, and she'll be presenting on the staff safety assessment. And then coming up in January, Dr. Jennifer Meddings and Linda Green will be presenting on the national policy surrounding CAUTI. So we hope you'll be able to join us for those two events. And any final thoughts from our guest presenters today?
This is Sanjay. I don't have anything else to add, but if people do have questions, they should feel free to reach out to us, either through our website, catheterapp.org, or through our email addresses. Mine is saint, S-A-I-N-T, at umich.edu. And we just appreciate their time.
Great, thank you. And if anyone has questions, feel free to email the project team. And as I mentioned, the recording of today's presentation along with the PowerPoints will be posted on our project website. We appreciate you all joining us today and hope you have a wonderful afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.